Hi, this is James White once again for the Solution Series, brought to you by Solari.com and Corey'sDigs.com. And I'm delighted to be joined, as always, by my co-host, Corey Lynn. Corey, always good to be with you.
Great to be here. Really, really looking forward to this one. I've been wanting to get Chris Allen on for a long time.
Indeed, I have been following her work for a long time, and I am excited as you are. Before we get Chris Ann on here, let's give her a brief introduction. Chris Ann Hall received her bachelor's degree in biochemistry from Blackburn College and her Juris Doctor from the University of Florida College of Law. She served in the U.S. Army as a military intelligence cryptologic linguist and was a prosecutor for the state of Florida for nearly a decade. Chris Ann also worked with a prominent national First Amendment law firm where she traveled the country defending Americans whose rights were violated by unlawful arrests and prosecutions. Chris Ann is the most sought-after national speaker on the Constitution, averaging over 250 events in nearly 22 states every year for 7 years straight. She has written 6 books on American history and the U.S. Constitution and has produced 2 documentaries about the power of the states and the duty of the sheriff. Chris Ann is also a professor at River University School of Government and chief counsel for Liberty First Legal, a national nonprofit law firm defending the civil rights of the people. Chris Ann is a regular consultant on the Constitution for numerous radio, podcast, and television programs. She has been seen on Victory News, Court TV, I-24 News, Law and Crime, Newsmax, Fox News, RT, and she has been interviewed by C-SPAN in depth, and her books and classes have been featured on C-SPAN Books TV. Chris Ann had a nationally popular radio show for over 8 years that has carried both on terrestrial and internet stations. Chris Ann lives in Tampa, Florida with her husband J.C. Hall and their adopted son Colton. She can be found at chrisannhall.com. And we're so delighted to have Chris Ann Hall with us here today on the Solution Series. Thanks so much for being here with us, Chris Ann.
It is my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Well, as you can see by the background here, we're going to be talking about the Constitution, and we couldn't have anybody better on to talk about it than yourself.
You can see by my background that I'm in Tampa, Florida.
Right on. We love Tampa. Tampa's great. Nice and warm down there. So, Chris Ann, we really...
Rainy today.
Again, we're just going to go ahead, and I think what we'd like to do maybe is start with the macro and then move into the micro. So, you know, overall, I guess maybe the first question would be, and I know, Corey, you probably have more questions than I. But maybe
I
why
can talk with I know hours on questions.
but why is it, you know, I guess I've seen a lot more recently about the Constitution. It's being brought up more in the news. More people are talking about it. Why do you think that is, Chris Ann? Why do you think that the Constitution seems to be more popular than ever? At least that's the way I'm seeing things. And then we'll just go on to the solutions.
Well, I think that because this is a, you know, sort of the macro, the 30,000 foot view, there are many answers to that question, not just one. I think that because now for, oh my gosh, at least 22 years, and I'm reflecting back on the Patriot Act as sort of a catalyst, when in reality it's been longer than that, because the John Birch Society's been teaching the Constitution and about constitutional government for a long time. But really, the Patriot Act in 2001 really made some people wake up and realize that there are things about the operation of government that they don't know, that they don't understand, and probably much of what they do understand is wrong. People also, over this time and most recently since the COVID lockdown, as parents have come face to face with what the government education system is actually teaching their kids. I mean, COVID was one of the best things that has ever happened to any movement of education reform in America. And what we have is a situation now where parents coming face to face with what their children were taught, realizing that they themselves were not taught how government is supposed to work, what the Constitution means. And then you have people like the 10th Amendment Center, the John Birch Society, Tom Woods, people like the Center for Self-Governance and the teachings that we've been doing now for over 13 years. I mean, we've been teaching now for 13 years. For 7 of those years, I average 260 classes in 22 states every single year. So I was actually only home 4 days a month and every other day off in some other city teaching, and sometimes 3 times a day in different cities every single day. So the magnitude, the amount of people that we have taught, and the vast geographic coverage we've taught in all 49 states. I've taught the legislators of 11 states in session. Several of those states have had me back for repeat trainings for freshman legislators. And I think because you have an initial awareness, or at least I would say an initial question that comes in people's minds, what the heck? This doesn't feel right. Why are we doing it this way? This has to be wrong, which leads people to the ultimate search and discovery of truth. And so when we're talking about the big picture and the 30,000 foot view, what we really are seeing is a cultural change. And I can tell you, 13 years ago when I started, we were already seeing a large number of young people coming out for our Constitution classes. And I'm not talking just because their parents are making them, because they want to. I mean, now 13 years later, I'm actually teaching the children of the children I taught. We would go to, and especially in the areas of the country we would consider most liberty suppressed or oppressed, in the Northwest, even 10 years ago, I would go to teach and have groups of 300, 400, 500 people come to my Constitution classes. And two-thirds of those would be 25 years or younger. And so it's really, really amazing. What we are seeing is the whole proverbial, stuff the pipe, eventually something's going to fall out the other side. And what began as sort of a moderate counterculture to the dictated government socialist-led narrative is a full-on scale revolution of the mind, where a large group of the population is really actively seeking. And the reason you hear about it more is that people remain a silent majority because they lack confidence in what they know. They think they know, they believe they know, they have a really strong feeling about what they know, but they don't have a confidence in what they know. And lack of confidence will keep us quiet because we're afraid we might come up against somebody that might know more than we do, and then we look like an idiot. So the bottom line is the cultural shift to the seeking of knowledge, the acquisition and the availability of that knowledge, which didn't exist before, or at least the ease of ability, has led to a greater confidence in that knowledge, and people are standing up and speaking more. And, when people feel the most uncomfortable is when they speak out. And what's happening is I guess the good side of the flip of the bad coin is that the more people become uncomfortable in their economic station, in their political station, in their spiritual station, or their social station, the more uncomfortable they feel, the more willing they are to speak up.
Excellently stated. And I highly recommend. So you put out, I believe it was in 2020, Noncompliant, the
Right.
movie, which noncompliantmovie.com is where people can go to see that. And I highly recommend everyone watch that because I love the way you simplify things and break things down so that everyone of all ages can understand. And one of the big questions I would love for you, and I don't know if you can do this in a nutshell, but I think there's a lot of confusion between, where the power lies and the state constitution versus the the federal government and the federal constitution. And I think there's a lot of confusion there. And as you point out, a lot over the years, all of the big gov pull and distractions to take your eyes off the states so that you're so focused on the presidency and the federal government, who is doing so many things that are unconstitutional, that you're not focused on the local and state level. And so if there's a way to kind of nutshell that so people understand the true power we really have and where it resides in the states.
Well, it's really interesting. Obviously, in this short period of time that we'll be together, there's greater depth of answers than and greater proofs of answers that I'm not able to give. So I just want to start off by saying there are two ways you can learn from us. Well, technically three ways, but the two easiest ways to learn from us are, number one, through libertyfirstsociety.com, which is all our online training. It is a small monthly membership, and it, you know, I mean, it's cheaper than any online education that's actually worth something. I mean, you can get free instruction all the time, but that instruction is so superficial, it'll actually, you know, give you just enough information to hurt yourself, or they're not teaching you the truth. We guarantee that everything that we teach at Liberty First Society is not based on opinion or political perspective, but based on actual historical documented truth. So everything we teach about American history and everything that we teach about the Constitution, the proper role of government, and the lessons that we learn from the good and bad things that we've done in the past are all based on what we call original source text. So I don't teach what other history books write. I teach what the people who wrote, who lived the history, and that's what original source means. The second way that you can learn from me is to actually come to River University in Tampa, Florida. We have a three-year program called the River School of Government, where you actually can get a bachelor's degree in our government studies. It is a Christian school, so it will be Christian government studies, but we teach everything, regardless of what it is, from a constitutional and accurate historical perspective. So that's River University if you want to come to a brick and mortar school. Intake for our River School of Government is only in August, one time a year. So if that's something you're interested in, you need to go to riverschoolofgovernment.com and find out how to do that. We are also able to offer a $16,000 or a $1,600 scholarship. Is that right, Christian? Is it 16,000 or 1600? I don't remember. Anyway, a very significant scholarship so that by the end of the year, your bachelor degree will only cost you about $2,500. If you come to River University and all that.
Wow.
Yeah, all of that is something that we can help you with. The third way is to have us come and teach, which is what I'm about to do. Soon as I get off this interview, I'm going to be rushing out the door to the airport because I'll be in Missouri, in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, this weekend teaching. And so to answer that question in a nutshell, everything that creates confusion about the proper division of power is taught from error. It is an error that we began teaching in 1830. And I know that year, that's the year we started teaching it, because in 1833, we actually threw aside the textbooks on the proper application, the proper operation of our constitutional republic that were written by the founders themselves. We threw them out and we picked up a textbook written by a former Supreme Court justice by the name of Joseph Story. And Joseph Story's treatise on the Constitution in 1833 changed everything that the people learned about how the government was supposed to work. And so if you go into this question understanding that 99.9% of American people, which will be even a greater percentage of those who went to law school, who work in government, have been taught the wrong things about the division of power in our constitutional republic, you'll have a much easier time in accepting and realizing the truth. The division of power can be easily summed in a very general statement that probably leaves more questions than it answers, but it's just as simple as this. The states were created July 2nd, 1776. The states immediately, as possible, created the Articles of Confederation, which were our first union, and the first semblance of central government. When the Articles of Confederation were on the verge of failing and the Union was about to split, the delegates from the states got together, and this is very important, the delegates from the states got together, and they debated, voted, and ratified over long term the Constitution of the United States that we have right now. So the first thing that we must understand is the states created the Constitution. The Constitution is a contract, and to any legitimate constitutional historian, that is a factual reality. There are historians and academic idiots who try to put the question mark behind that fact that the Constitution is contract in order to undermine its authority and efficacy. And so the states are the creators of the Constitution, which is a contract. The Constitution creates the federal government. Without the Constitution's ratification, there would be no federal government. There would only be independent, sovereign states, which are the political equivalent, each of them, countries. So individual sovereign countries without the Constitution. With the Constitution, we have a union of independent sovereign countries that has created a central government for a singular purpose, to represent the states in foreign affairs. So the states created the Constitution. The Constitution created the federal government, which means that the states are the creators of the federal government. The 10th Amendment explains that relationship in this way. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The power the federal government holds is a delegated power via the Constitution. The states created the Constitution. The Constitution created the federal government. The Constitution delegated certain limited powers to the federal government. So we know the states are the delegators of power to the federal government. Now, the definition of the word delegate is really important here. And the definition of that word delegate means a temporary transfer of responsibility or authority from a higher power to a lower power. So knowing that the states are the delegators of power to the federal government, we know that the power the federal government operates is done so with the permission of the states. The states in this relationship, by the definition of the word delegate, are the higher power and the federal government is the lower power. If you want some more in-depth explanation about this power, like specifically what power is delegated, what power is reserved, at Liberty First University, at libertyfirstsociety.com, I have a class on state sovereignty. I also have a book that I've written called Sovereign Duty that's all about that. The documentary, Noncompliant, is all about that separation of power and the delegation of power to the federal government and the retention of power by the states. Something that you can just pick up and read online that might help you. Well, the book Sovereign Duty is available on Kindle, so I don't know if you have that. You can get it there as well. But James Madison wrote about this relationship in Federalist 45, and he says explicitly, the powers delegated to the federal government are few and defined, meaning they're specifically enumerated. The power that remains in the states is numerous and indefinite. And he says the powers that are delegated to the federal government will be reserved to foreign affairs, war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. Powers that are reserved to the states will include everything else, including the ordinary course of affairs. He calls them the lives, the liberties, the property of the people, the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. So when we understand all of that, we know that the federal government's only realm of authority exists because the states have delegated a portion of their power to the federal government for the purpose of representation in foreign affairs. The federal government's realm is foreign, and each state is left with its domestic governance without federal intervention.
So you're just talking about...
Go ahead, Jim.
You're just talking about an outrageous overstepping of their power. Now, it may sound simplistic, but we know that they only have the power that they have due to the consent of the governed. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's, and you can certainly correct me, but in law, if you don't object, don't you pretty much, isn't that pretty much silent consent? So is it just a matter of the reason that they continue to do what they're doing is because we just don't object? Do we just need, I know it's probably not that simple, but if we don't give them our consent, then constitutionally they don't have power. Am I off base on that?
Well, actually, our documentary noncompliant really, really helps with that understanding. And it is actually just that simple. The establishment of our constitutional republic is unique in the fact that we actually created government, the central government, from the states. So as the creation of the states, the states are the creator. In our constitutional republic paradigm, the states retain the states retain oversight over the federal government. And so the answer really is that simple. As a matter of fact, Alexander Hamilton wrote that no law, therefore, contrary to the Constitution can be valid. James Wilson wrote that anything created by the federal government contrary to the Constitution will not have the force of law. Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution says that anything the federal government does that's outside or specifically not in pursuance of the Constitution is not binding on the states. And so the power of declaration that you're operating with outside your delegated authority is really rests in the hands of the states. And that's why our second documentary is all about the sheriff. Because the state and local governments are actually your most powerful and most practical defense of federal government overreach. Now, over the years, that's kind of been whittled away a little bit at the federal level, but it doesn't actually eliminate the reality that the states retain the authority to refuse not only to enforce federal acts outside the Constitution, contrary to the Constitution, but also to refuse to allow the federal government to enforce them in their state. And so it is just that simple. It's noncompliance. It's peaceful noncompliance. It's just simply the recognition that you have no power over me because I never delegated to you any power over me. The distinction becomes the consented power, as you mentioned. Let me give you this analogy. If I go away on vacation, and you know that I've gone away on vacation, and the day I leave, you know I'm going to be gone 3 weeks. The day I leave, you came and stole my car. And you're driving around in my car and you've stolen it. You don't have my permission. So your taking of my car is an illegal act. Your driving of my car is an illegal act. But I don't know you've done it. And because I don't know you've done it, I haven't objected. Now, 3 weeks later, I come home and I notice my car is gone. And you've got it. You cannot legally assert that you've been driving my car for 3 weeks without any objection as claim of ownership of my car. I now have the authority, because I am the owner of that car, to object, even though I haven't for 3 weeks, and even if I was gone 3 months, I still had the authority to object now. And that's kind of what's happened in America. The American people have been taught the wrong things for so long that they don't realize the federal government has actually stolen power from the states. Our continued consent doesn't establish legal authority to the federal government because it's still stolen. It is our objection, however, that's necessary to stop the continuation of that theft. And I don't have to sue you to get my car back. I simply have to provide the title deed to the car, and it must be returned to me of its rightful owner. States do not have to sue the federal government to get their power back. When states sue the federal government for power that's rightfully theirs, they're actually committing a dangerous act. Because then what they're saying is that the federal government, through the federal courts, is the ultimate authority of federal power. So what state governors and sheriffs, which are the highest authority in your county, the highest executive authority in your county, even in your state. So in your county, your sheriff is the highest executive authority, who's even superior to your governor if your governor is ordering unconstitutional things. And it's the authority of these entities, your county commission, your city council, anybody in state government that takes an oath that says, I do solemnly swear I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of your state. It's their duty and their authority to refuse to comply and to refuse to allow that power to be exercised. And that's the recognition, that's the demand. And the title deed to that authority is the Constitution. So Thomas Jefferson talked about it I talk about it in the book Sovereign Duty and in my classes, but the reality is that when the federal government is using power that has not been delegated, it's actually committing criminal theft of the power that belongs to the state.
Color of law, is that color of law theft?
No, it's actual theft.
Oh, it's actual theft, right.
Yeah. Well, what do you call the Constitution of the United States? The supreme what?
Document.
Supreme. Law of the land. Article 6, Clause 2 calls the Constitution the supreme law of the land. If you violate the law, what is that?
It's a crime.
It's a crime. So when they exercise power contrary to the delegation in the Constitution, which not simply delegates power to the federal government, but reserves everything that's not delegated to the states.
So now from a local and state standpoint, from a personal standpoint, we've seen tons of examples of all of this throughout the last few years during COVID. We've seen some states step up and say, we're going to make masks are not mandatory here. Or jabs are not mandatory here. We've seen that across the board. And of course, unfortunately, we seem to see the divide with red states and blue states on which front, which approach they're taking there. But then you have, on a personal level, you have business owners that say, well, we're not going to lock down, or we're not going to wear masks. And of course, if you go into a retailer who says you can't come in unless you wear a mask, I don't know that you have much standing there, because it's a personal company. It's not like big gov telling you this. However, when you start to see police officers going in and enforcing this, now we have a problem, and we did see a lot of people stand up to that, but I think we saw more people go ahead and lock their doors. And as you've pointed out, there's going to be times where we have to get really uncomfortable, and some of this is going to get really tough, but it's really the only way to fight back, and until everyone's educated enough to kind of flip this system back the way it should be. So one of the main there's like two main topics going on right now. One is, of course, the whole IHR WHO, where they're saying they want the WHO in charge. And we've already got, I believe, a couple states speaking up about that. Didn't DeSantis say something to the effect of they're not, and I don't know how that works, because then you look at all the different areas they weave through and how they connect in with Big Corp, and they tell Big Corp, well, you follow along. And so it just becomes so sort of complex for people, individuals, to navigate. And I'm just wondering, what are some good tools, aside from educating themselves and, of course, non-compliance, moving forward through this, all this tyranny we're seeing here, what are some good tools, some good ways for people to go about this on a personal level, a local level, you know, a state level? What do you recommend?
Samuel Adams said, "No people will tamely surrender their liberties nor be easily subdued when knowledge is diffused and virtue is preserved." He said, "On the contrary, when the people become universally ignorant and debauched in their manners, they will sink underneath their own weight without the aid of foreign invaders." And so what we must understand is that Samuel Adams has identified the problem and the solution right there. And a lot of times, and I don't mean this to sort of slight what you've said, but a lot of times people are like, well, what can I do besides getting educated? All right, first you have to get educated. And first you have to recognize that the education that you think you have is likely not accurate. And so there has to be an acceptance, an ability to accept, to receive truth when you think you already know it. Like, I travel the country and I ask people to name the five liberties of the First Amendment. I mean, these are not just random people. This is not your Mark Dice man on the street thing. These are people who consider themselves conservatives, who consider themselves constitutionally focused, and they have come because they have an interest in the Constitution. 13 years I've been asking, name all five liberties of the First Amendment. I can tell you without hesitation, less than 2% of any given crowd that I teach can name all five liberties of the First Amendment. So education is not just simply something we can do. It is the key. Without it, nothing can work. Without it, we become a people who drive for the wrong thing with the right reasons. We are the Christians who tell George Bush to pass the Defense of Marriage Act, which without the Defense of Marriage Act, there would be no LGBTQ movement at all. So the road to hell is paved with good intentions of people who think they know, but don't know what they don't know. And so education has to be the essential first step. And it has to be an education that is actually accurate. Once that education happens, then you being educated doesn't help anything, because you on the world is really not effective, with specific exceptions in mind. So you have to educate other people, because we must have unity in this truth. Thomas Paine said, "It's not in numbers that we gather our strength, but in unity." And we must be unified in the right truths. Because you see, the reality is this: any treaty, any agreement, number one, that Biden or any other president signs with the WHO is an invalid treaty. And according to Article 2 and according Article 6 of the Constitution, those treaties are invalid and therefore are not binding on anyone, just like I said before. So the president of the United States' authority of the executive branch is delegated in Article 2. Article 2 outlines the terms of a treaty. The only treaties that are valid under Article 2 are treaties that are negotiated by the president and then ratified by two-thirds of the Senate. There is no authority for the president of the United States to make unilateral deals with foreign entities. They can make them all day long, but they're not binding. And that's the key. Somebody will say, well, Congress passed this act that gave the president this authority. Well, let me tell you what. Article 6, Clause 2 says that any act of the government not made in pursuance to the Constitution is not binding. Congress does not have the authority to expand, diminish, or change executive authority different from the Constitution through simple legislation. The only way to lawfully, legally change presidential authority is to amend the Constitution. And Article 5 dictates the very arduous manner in which that happens. Now, even if a president negotiates a constitution and it's ratified by 2/3 of the Senate, Article 6, Clause 2 tells us that that treaty may not even be valid still, because treaties, in order to be valid, must be made under the authority of the federal government, which means treaties can only be lawfully constitutionally made when they involve delegated authority to the federal government. There has been no authority delegated to the federal government to regulate, govern, or dictate our health. Any treaty with the World Health Organization, even if ratified by the Senate, is a null and void treaty because it's outside the authority of the United States. And that is, I've just told you in a nutshell, in 5 minutes or less, a knowledge that if the people possessed, this would be a nothing burger, a non-issue. And we would be electing people to office at the state and local level that knew this as well. And you wouldn't need legislation, and you wouldn't need big pomp and circumstance. You would actually have governors and sheriffs that would be like, the heck do they think they're doing, right? Like, that's going to have any power here? I don't think so. I mean, it would just be an absurdity. And as a matter of fact, our founders referred to it, or the possibility of it, as an absurdity. So we have to get not just a simple knowledge. We have to have a convicting, controlling, physical heart knowledge of how this is supposed to work, and the power we retain when it is ignored.
Okay, that just brings up, I just have to interject on a slight side topic here, but along the same line. So because that kind of answered my question with the laundering with immunity series I've been working on that I had mentioned to you, where we've now got 76 organizations, 22 of which make up the UN. We're starting back in 1945, Congress designated to the presidents that by executive order, they could assign privileges and immunities to these international organizations. So now we've got banks, the Bank of International Settlements as well, separately from this. And then we have these 76 organizations, and now we've got these treaties. And this went all the way up through Obama handing out these. So, I mean, all of that completely, which I already knew, but the way you broke it down, now I understand. So,
you know, Corey, what's really interesting about that, okay,
yeah,
is first you have to recognize, number one, the Constitution doesn't delegate that authority to the president. Number two, the Congress does not have the authority to delegate power to the president that's not already delegated via the Constitution. It has to be done by amendment to the Constitution. But number three, and probably more relevantly so, Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist 69 all about the power of the president, the delegated power to the president. And he did so with an analytical comparison between the power that a king possesses and the power, the limited power, that a president will possess. Because the whole argument in ratifying the Constitution was you had a group of people who were instrumental in writing the Constitution. They were there for the debates. They know everything that went into it, and they know how it's supposed to work. But then you have a second group of people who have not been involved in the very detailed, intricate debates that took place, who are now reading the Constitution and have specific concerns. One of their concerns was, by having a single executive head rather than a tribunal or a committee in the executive branch, was that you're really establishing over a period of time the predisposition in human nature to transform that president, even though beginning with a limited and defined power, into a king. And so in Federalist 69, Alexander Hamilton lays out this just beautiful comparative analysis of what we've, if you follow the Constitution, this will be the power of the president. And we made the power of the president specifically the way it is so he wouldn't be anywhere remotely to be a king. And one of those things that Hamilton really points out as a distinction is exactly what you're talking about. Hamilton says, we do not give the president the kingly authority to create denizens and to grant marks and privileges, because that would be a power of a king. So when you have Congress doing exactly unconstitutionally, because it's not by amendment, and specifically what those who created the office of the president said we deliberately did not do for this particular reason, what you have is the ultimate evidence that the society has fallen into universal ignorance and they no longer have the courage or the knowledge to stand against that. And if you were to say that now, we are so far down the road, because individuals who reference the Federalist Papers are considered radicals and lunatics. I actually got into, when I first got started, like 2011, I think, I got into a very heated discussion here in Tallahassee, in our state capital, with the Senate president, who was a Republican, who considered himself a constitutionalist historian. And when I mentioned to him the Federalist Papers, when I mentioned to him what Madison said about the separation of power between the state and the federal government, he accused me of having seances to know what Madison said. And I said to him, no, sir, I don't have to have a seance. Madison wrote down what he said in the Federalist Papers. And here you have a Republican who has risen to the level of being the Senate president in the state of Florida, who considers himself a constitutionalist, a historian of the American Constitution and history, telling me that it's ludicrous that we can know what the founders meant when they wrote the Constitution. So that's how deep this goes. And that's why I said it's great that we have this information, right? I mean, I think it's wonderful that we have this information, but it's why I've traveled for 13 years, you know, 4 days a month at home, because me possessing this level of knowledge doesn't help the country. We've got to have a minimum of 3% of the people who can unify in that knowledge to make a difference.
I think that's fantastic. You wanted to say something, James?
I wanted to switch a topic. So if you want to follow up with that, Corey, go right ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
So, Chris Ann, one of the things I think, you know, you can't boil it down to any one particular item, but you know, some of the stuff that I've done and people I've interviewed, I notice a lot, what comes up a lot is the term jurisdiction, and they don't really have the jurisdiction in some cases to the authority that they exercise over us or attempt to. They don't really have the jurisdiction to exercise that authority, yet they do so anyway. So if someone had to look into, like a starting point, would looking up jurisdiction, you talk about getting to know it and getting to really get to embrace it, would that be a good starting point for folks to look at jurisdiction and to get to define that and get to know what that means? Because that seems to be sort of at the center of a lot of these things that are going on, is lack of jurisdiction. Would you care to comment on that?
Jurisdiction is a very general term, and I don't think the definition of jurisdiction per se would actually help you. What you need to know is what is the jurisdiction. And the Constitution of the United States lines out the jurisdiction of the federal government, just like I told you. Article 1 tells you the jurisdiction of the legislative branch. Article 2 shows you the jurisdiction of the executive branch, and Article 3 shows you the jurisdiction of the executive branch. And same way your state constitution works. Your state constitution lays out the jurisdiction of your legislative, executive, and judicial branches. So it's equally important to know the Constitution of the United States as it is to know your state constitution. Because if we're honest, the lockdowns all came through a state and local level. And every single one of the lockdowns in every single state violated at least five provisions of each state constitution. I've traveled and taught the state constitution specifically for the last 3 years, and I can't count how many times I've taught a state constitution within the state, and I've had people come to me and tell me they didn't even know they had a state constitution. So we've got to get people educated that the state governments are limited in their power by the constitution of the state. The U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land. The state constitution is the supreme law of the state. They don't contradict each other when they're working properly. They actually work in tandem. And so what's important is that we understand who, I think, initially, not only just what is the delegation of power, because that's actually what jurisdiction means, the delegation of power. What are the boundaries of that authority? Who has the authority to enforce jurisdiction? And that's really a very, very important matter. And that's why our documentary about the sheriff and our documentary Noncompliant. So our first documentary is called Noncompliant. Our second documentary is called Noncompliant to the Sheriff. All of this is about that term jurisdiction. What is the limit of federal jurisdiction? And who determines that? How is that determined? Well, the limit to federal jurisdiction is determined by the Constitution. The enforcement of that jurisdiction is done by your state and local government, most powerfully and completely by your sheriff. And most people don't really understand the duty of the sheriff and the fact that history, beginning in the year 849, has worked to develop the authority of the sheriff, not as an enforcer of the law, but as a defender of the rights of the people.
849, you said? 849?
849, yes.
Wow.
So if you go watch Noncompliant to the Sheriff, I give you that very brief overview of that history in that movie, because really Noncompliant to the Sheriff is inspired by a 3-hour course, continuing education course, that I teach to sheriffs and deputies across the country. And I've been doing that for about 7 years now. And I just had so many people telling me, nobody knows this. We need to know this. How do we know this? And I say, well, I wrote a book, Sovereign Duty. It's in the chapters there. But in reality, I understand that we have a multimedia society and people like movies, they like these kind of things. So that's why we turned it into a documentary. And in 54 minutes, Noncompliant to the Sheriff will teach you unequivocally and powerfully how the jurisdiction of the state and federal governments are both limited and enforced.
Thank
and
you.
just so we're clear, it's Noncompliant Part 2 is the sheriff.
Yeah.
So noncompliant. It sounds like you're saying be noncompliant to your sheriff.
yeah. Noncompliant to the sheriff is a history of and duty of a history that builds the duty and the obligation of the sheriff. We should not be calling our sheriff a law enforcement officer. That's not the duty of the sheriff. He doesn't take an oath to enforce the law. The duty of the sheriff is a defender of the rights of the people. And in defense of the rights of the people, he enforces laws that are consistent with the Constitution. That's how that works. Noncompliant one is how the states are the essential check and balance on federal authority. And both of them can be found at noncompliantmovie.com.
Excellent. And I just want to quickly go over, because if people go into libertyfirstsociety.com, they can browse all your courses. You have an enormous amount of courses on there. You have video lessons, the films, activism boot camp, textbooks.
Yeah, we even have a homeschool a directive there.
Yeah, and tell us just a little bit about that with the homeschooling, because I know you said just all different ages with that as well.
Yeah, so what's the beauty of what we offer exists in the fact that what we know about, what we should know about history and what we should know about the Constitution is not complicated. It's actually a device, sort of an academic bullying, to keep people ignorant of the Constitution. We've taught people for decades that you have to be a scholar to to understand the Constitution. I just got in a discussion the other day, a very frustrating discussion the other day, with someone who is in leadership of a statewide constitutional organization, who told me, well, you know, we can't all be scholars and understand the Constitution, right? And then I gotta go, right? Because you don't have to be a scholar to understand the Constitution. It is very simply written. We don't need an interpretation of the Constitution. It's not written in Mandarin Chinese. And words mean what they mean. And anytime you don't understand a provision or there's a vague concept in the Constitution, which doesn't happen, but I know people like to see those kind of things, then you go to the writings of the founders and they tell you exactly what they meant. In 13 years, I have been challenged in what I've taught by some very, very high placed and very, very educated people. And every time I have been asked a question about the Constitution with somebody who wanted to stump me, without fail, the answer is found in the writings of those who wrote the Constitution. Because they asked and answered all the questions. And that seems kind of supernatural that they could do something like that. But they really, really dove in and discussed it because it really is just about human nature and it's about government. And human nature is very predictable. And so our homeschool curriculum is really just the beginning, right? It is a kernel of core classes that we offer. So that homeschool parents, and I believe every parent is a homeschool parent, by the way. I don't care where you send your child to school, because ultimately and eternally, what your child knows begins and ends in the home, not in the school. So we will be held responsible for what our children learn, regardless of where we send them to learn it. And so we have to be the ultimate check and balance no matter where they go to school. So we have lots of people who supplement their education with our curriculum. I say curriculum very loosely, our classes. And so the homeschool core is a way to help parents understand how the courses all go together and start off with a beginning set of courses that they can then launch into all the remaining, because we have dozens and dozens of courses. But it really is important to start at that core foundation, because laying a foundation of education is essential to really getting the higher level concepts. It's sort of like the knowledge that we know, if you want to learn calculus, you'd better start with an addition and subtraction. So the homeschool core is really teaching our children the addition subtraction principles of governance and government so that they can go out and take the rest of our courses as electives in whichever order they want to and be able to retain and understand and apply the concepts.
That's so awesome. I'm so glad you did that.
And in reality, Corey, we have students from sixth grade through law school. We actually have groups on law school campuses that take all the courses at libertyfirstsociety.com because they realize they're not learning what they should be learning about the Constitution in law school.
That's fantastic.
So the courses are designed to be in such a way that they're delivered with a simplicity that a middle schooler can get it, understand it, and benefit from it, while a true seeker of scholarly knowledge, somebody who thinks themselves to be a scholar, will still get enormous benefit from them.
I love it. So I don't know if this is probably going to be too loaded of a topic, but since it's so prominent right now and we're in the thick of this, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the banking situation. I know the Federal Reserve, that's just a whole conversation there. But with them talking about going into the digital currency, and now you have some states standing up and saying, well, we're not going to make it so that we're cashless here and we're not going to, you know, and I'm thinking, gosh, talk about a web. How are we going to manage our way through this? So I would just love to know what your thoughts are on this banking situation.
Well, there's an And, yeah, I mean, this is probably a good place for us to sort of wrap up because this is a direct solutionary issue, right? Because the real issue here, or the real solution, is a constitutional solution. And it's a solution that has already happened, so we know that it works. And what the solution to the federal government dictating digital money is that each state must start a state bank. And a state bank will leave to the people of that state the ability and the authority to conduct banking on constitutional terms, right? Digital currency would not be a constitutional currency. In reality, paper money is not a constitutional currency either. It's not based on weight and measure. It's a fiat, okay? And so, and also just as a sort of note for those who like to research things and might be sort of judicial nerds like me, there's case precedent that says that the federal government cannot eliminate the use of gold, silver, and currency, and they cannot prohibit people from using paper money either. And so by establishing a digital currency, the case law and the precedent says that they can do it maybe in addition, but they cannot do it in exclusion. And so what would happen then is that banking would return to the state because banking is not a federal authority. We never delegated the authority to the federal government to engage in banking and to regulate banking. We only gave them the authority to dictate the weights and measure of money, of coin money, to establish what the gold value is, what the silver value is, and to make the derivative denominations based on the weight of silver and gold. And so the states can lawfully, even by legal precedent, return to weights and measures of gold and silver, and they can still use the federal fiat if they want. But they can only really enforce that and have an authority with that if they create a state bank. North Dakota created a state bank a long time ago. They've had a state bank for a long time. And it's something I've really looked into. It's something that I've sort of as a hobby kind of passion. And I believe that North Dakota was headed in the right direction. They didn't actually go as far as they should have. But what should happen is each state should create a state bank, which is the equivalent of a credit union, right? It's not, it is separate from the FDIC. We should not be allowing the FDIC. There's no federal authority for the federal government to insure money. And by doing so, by issuing insurance, the federal government actually has the authority, like they did those banks that they just shut down in the Silicon Valley Bank. A bank that had over $2 billion in assets, all of a sudden the Federal Reserve says you don't have enough money, you know, you don't have enough assets. Well, that shouldn't be the federal government's determination. The capital market should be the determination of that. And so a state bank would be outside the FDIC, would not be controlled by quantitative easing of the Federal Reserve, and would have an authority to refuse federal governance and federal seizures of banking money without due process. And so garnishments and asset forfeitures would be refused by the states without proper due process. And all of that can happen when the state has a state bank and then goes further than North Dakota and actually has state bank branches so that actual banking can take place. It's not just a clearinghouse.
You're bringing back memories of an interview I did with Bernard von Nothaus several years ago. He came up with the Liberty Dollar, and they threw that guy in jail and confiscated all of his stuff. Chris Ann Hall, great to have you here with us today. Before we go ahead and wrap up the podcast here, would you mind giving out your email, not your email addresses, but your website, anywhere people can find out more about your information? I know you've mentioned your website a couple of times, but you mentioned you're on Twitter now, if you want to give that information out, just where people can find out more about your stuff.
Well, the main hub website is my name, chrisannhall.com. And we also have our online constitution training at libertyfirstsociety.com. And then we have our two documentaries at noncompliantmovie.com. I am on Twitter, which is at Real K.A. Hall. I am on Instagram, Chris Ann Hall. I am on Facebook, Chris Ann Hall. And I'm on LinkedIn, Chris Ann Hall. So basically, if you just search my name, you'll find me. Be aware that there are fake accounts out there. It should be easy enough to determine which ones are fake and which ones are real.
Great stuff, Cord. Anything you'd like to say before we go ahead and close things up?
No, I just want to thank you so much for coming on. I've been wanting to get you on and talk with you for a long time. So super appreciate your knowledge and your motivation. You're a firecracker. I could listen to you talk all day long.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And just a reminder to everybody that I will be in Missouri this weekend. I'll be Fitchburg, Massachusetts next weekend. So anybody in those areas, we'd love to see you.
Right. Good times. All right, folks, we're just out of time here on the podcast. We just want to thank our guest, Chris Ann Hall, for being here with us. If you want to know more about what we've got going on, you can go to Solari.com or Corey'sDigs.com and check out the previous episodes that we've had. And we want to thank our guest, Chris Ann Hall, again for being here today. Till next time, this is James White for the Solution Series. Saying bye now.